Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEdDean.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEdDean.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEdDean.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners, all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast Seminar. Our guest today is Professor Paul Fryters, who is the Professor of Wellbeing Economics at the London School of Economics. He specializes in applied microeconometrics, including labor, happiness, and health economics. His main area of interest is analyzing how socioeconomic variables affect human life experience and the unanswerable economic mysteries in life. Professor Fryters is a prominent research economist and has published over 150 papers in fields including unemployment policy, discrimination, and economic development. But he joins us today to talk about his latest book, The Great COVID Panic. I think Professor Fryters has provided an absolutely outstanding analysis of the topic of the Great COVID Panic at a time when very few economists have asked the tough questions about the effectiveness and the economic consequences of the measures that have been carried out across the world. Professor Fryters has done some very important and I think interesting work on these economic impacts, and we're delighted to have him join us today. So, Professor Paul, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be on the show, SaifEdDean. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah, close enough. SaifEdDean, yeah. It's I'm easy on pronunciation, doesn't matter much. Okay, so I guess we'll start with you, if you could just give us a little bit of an overview of the main theses of your latest book, The Great COVID Panic.
Thanks, Saifedean. Yes, together with two co-authors, one is in America and the other one is in Australia. We sort of wrote this booklet in order to bring together all the sort of social science thoughts on the great COVID panic, on sort of what's happened the last 20 months, and to look at it from various angles. So we document what's happened, you know, the virus starting in Wuhan, origins unknown, how it then fanned out over the world, and how the policies sort of fanned out over the world, namely these kind of draconian lockdowns as a somewhat futile effort to control the virus, and how, as it were, the whole world population got into a panic. So that was sort of, you know, February, March last year, and that's why we call it the Great COVID Panic, and called en masse for all kinds of draconian policies to supposedly stop the virus from spreading. And lots of governments did that, although some governments bravely, like an Asterix, sort of, you know, refused to be overwhelmed by the forces of panic. And those countries have done markedly better, we find, even in terms of COVID outcomes. So the dire predictions were sort of shown to be nonsense. And then we document how, as it were, the panic started to be abused more and more, that as draconian policies came in, politicians saw a chance for more power. So we saw increases in autocratic government all over the world, including in many Western countries where we never thought that human rights would be, as it were, set aside to this degree. And we also document, as it were, the huge cost to human life of these policies, particularly lockdown policies and social distancing policies, which of course makes lots of people lonelier, makes them less healthy. Both the economy and the health system stopped functioning so well. So in fact, the number of victims grew a lot larger as a result of these policies rather than reduce them. And we document how there was an increasingly a coalition of politicians, businessmen who happened to benefit from this, who as it were, fanned the flames of the panic on and on and on, and how that gave rise to national crowds who were sort of totally obsessed with these policies and with this disease, and that sort of, you know, was almost like a stampede which could go anywhere. And then we analyze where things may go. We're economists, so we'd like to think constructively, not just complain about what happened, but also think about, okay, what can we now do? You know, given this stampede, given the enormous damage that's being done and still ongoing right now, what can well-thinking people do? And, you know, how can they prepare for the future? And one of the things is, like what you offer yourself, to offer alternative media. We definitely think that that is one way to go, to break the monopolies that are there of the major networks in order to get more independent thinking in the bloodstream of our societies, and to set up real alternative structures of science and civilization.
Fantastic. And so, I mean, I think some of the conclusions that you have arrived at are beyond the pale for the majority of academics. What for me was extremely remarkable over the last few months, last 18 months, is the almost complete lack of debate on these issues. I mean, if you had asked anybody in December 2019, what do you think of a scenario in which a disease breaks out and then governments do those things? I think 90% of people would have said, that's insane. We would not do that. You could not imagine the US and the UK and France and Holland and Norway and Australia. You know, maybe China might do this. Maybe some African despots might try things like this. But obviously, you know, Western democracies would not do something like this. And yet, by March and April, it was 99% of people who were just acting as if this is just basic common sense. Well, yeah, of course we're going to lock everybody up in their home indefinitely, because otherwise, you know, people will die. Do you want people to die then? No, we have to lock people up. I found it absolutely amazing how little debate there has been. And I think in particular, academics are extremely guilty of this. And I'll kick off with a little bit of an admission. You know, I consider myself an Austrian economist, and so you know, we are skeptical of empirical economics. Empirical economists might joke about Austrians and say there are three types of Austrian economists: those who can count and those who can't.
But I think, you know, there is a counterpoint to this joke, which is that empirical economics ultimately is only as useful as your a priori assumptions and as your ability to analyze the data. Data on its own doesn't tell you anything. You have to look at it. And so generally, I'm kind of skeptical of the ability of empirical economics on its own to tell us things. And I think this episode over the last 18 months has only strengthened my skepticism and validated it, because what we found was that what you would expect to be the kind of empirical economics that asks critical and tough questions about what's going on, you know, there's an enormous number of empirical economists around the world, and they do extremely sophisticated mathematical and statistical studies, extremely sophisticated questions, and arrive at extremely sophisticated conclusions. And, you know, you think of, say, the Freakonomics people, and it's done within development economics, and it's done in all kinds of fields. And, you know, you could make a great case for why those things happen. I think, in my mind, and having studied a lot of empirical economics in graduate school, I've come to the skeptical conclusion, which is that, you know, most of the time, either these numbers show us what we already know, or they're basically manipulated in order to arrive at the conclusions that help the authors get funding. And I think the last 18 months have made me think that this is too generous of an assessment, because, you know, you look at, for instance, somebody like Nate Silver, or the Freakonomics guys, you know, when this happened, it's amazing. Like, all of their statistical techniques, all of their, all of the math, all the sophisticated math was just deployed for one purpose all the time, which is rationalizing and justifying the dictates of power. It was astonishing. You know, no matter how absurd the World Health Organization recommendations were, you had an empirical economist come up and say, oh, well, actually, you know, here we run a bunch of numbers, and yep, the World Health Organization is right. Mm-hmm. Everybody should take off their masks and never wear a mask ever again. And then 2 weeks later, oh, no, actually, we've run the numbers, and everybody needs to wear 3 masks forever. This is the new normal. You know, maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but maybe not a lot. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to sort of, you know, agree very much in broad lines that economists, and particularly the empirical economists, have not merely been missing in action. They've sort of been egging on the madness, right? And early on, they sort of banded together, particularly in the US, with all kinds of petitions in which they called for draconian lockdowns, which they said they were sort of totally convinced were going to be very good with no negative effects. And this is a total abrogation of duty. You know, they were, instead of sort of being calm and rational and sitting back and looking at this like normal economists, like costs and benefits, which did happen, by the way, but more outside of academia, more in central banks, you saw the calm economists. They came up with reasonable scenarios. But now nearly all of the famous economists, empirical ones, seem to have lost their heads and immediately wanted to egg on the stampede and then, as you say, justify what happened in power. But I think it's important to put this in perspective, that is not merely empirical economists, but also economists have done this in the past. So we document that they did exactly the same thing with the Great Prohibition in the US. They also en masse lost their heads and just went along with what power was pushing. So I think it's more fair to say, particularly for the American economists, that as soon as great political power pushes something and there's great popularity, they just fall in line. You know, they're just not capable of independent thought then. And in that sense, they're not scientists, right? They just cannot, as it were, resist that social and political power. And then they don't. And then they just, you know, try to be the clever boy in the room who gives a reason for why the decision that was made by truly powerful people was correct all along. As you say, you know, basically just ex post rationalization, which is neither here nor there. But this happened all over science, right? There were masses of science calling for these lockdowns in February and March as well, with no real expertise, with no real look at what was likely to happen in terms of damage. It was sort of a mass abrogation of scientific duty. And we've not reestablished science in that sense. There's been a real parting of the ways.
Oh, absolutely. I agree entirely. I think Perhaps, for me, the most startling and the first thing to kick off the madness mathematically was our friend Niall Ferguson's extraordinary attempt at modeling the virus. So you discussed Niall Ferguson. I've had a few tweet threads about him that went a little bit viral because I found him absolutely fascinating. You discuss him in your book. Can you tell us a little bit more about your perspective on his work?
He's very much one of these scientists who was close to government and, of course, has a history of exaggerating what new disease will do. So he did this with swine flu and from other things that sort of happened. And then, and they were seen to be wrong, but that didn't cost him anything in his positions. But he found himself close to the UK government at the start of the pandemic and sort of, interestingly enough, gave the advice, which was the standard advice of that time, which was, based on 50 years of immunology and viral studies that you don't lock down, that will just have huge effects. And by the way, it will only postpone the moment at best in which these waves come. So there's no real point to doing that whatsoever. So in that sense, he did the right thing. But when it became clear that politically there were going to be lockdowns anyway, he, in absolute record time, sort of produced a novel argument, a model to rationalize why we should be having lockdowns, namely this notion that we should flatten the curve. In 2 weeks and after 18 months, here we are, the curve's not flat yet, is it? But this is kind of a novel argument, but it's a total sleight of hand, of course, because it sort of doesn't make the cost-benefit analysis as to, how much benefit is it actually if hospitals are not overwhelmed? Because they're regularly overwhelmed, as are all services of the state. They now and then have moments of being overwhelmed. That's not the end of the world. And so it was kind of like taken as gospel that that would be the end of the world. And so we had to avoid that. And that is not economic reasoning at all. But and then, of course, he plugged in these absurd numbers on the lethality of the virus, sort of saying, Armageddon will come soon unless we sort of flatten Armageddon over, chunkable sizes over time. So it's still Armageddon, but now in sizes. And as a result of that, of course, he kept his position in the middle of sort of the UK advisory leadership. And then when he flaunted some of the rules himself, he was kicked out of that advisory group. But then later on, he got back into it by shouting more apocalyptic predictions, despite the fact that his previous predictions, of course, were sort of falsifiably wrong. He nevertheless got in again by just shouting more predictions of doom, and so he's sort of UK's Dr. Doom, who has found a great business model. And I think I just heard him last week again saying, we might have to do this forever, and this is basically going very well for him. He must be very pleased.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's done himself a very good he's done very well for himself in terms of the career that he's carved out for himself. Now, interestingly enough, looking into this guy, this isn't his first rodeo. This is he's had many, many, you know, seemingly since the day that he was born, he's been writing all these crazy doomsday models about what is going to happen with diseases. And so back as early as 2000 or even in the 90s, he was making apocalyptic predictions about what swine flu was going to do and what MERS is going to do and what SARS is going to do. And every single time he was off by approximately 100%. You know, the actual death rate is within a 0.01% of the number that he predicted. And it's absolutely astonishing how such a character can continue to be taken seriously. I mean, I think in a sane society, I don't believe people should be put in asylum, in mental asylum houses, but this would be the intellectual equivalent of it. Why would anybody ever listen to this person or have him published? And yet, there he is.
There he is indeed, and it is a sign of our times and a little bit of a Western thing that we are in apocalyptic prediction times, right? There are apocalyptic predictions also about the climate, of course, and apocalyptic predictions about what may happen in wars in China, right? So there was a new weapon launched last week, and immediately the newspapers were full of apocalyptic predictions on that kind of arms race. And hence, in a way, it's a sign of the times that people are able to get attention for shouting apocalypses. But I wanted to say something in agreement with your statement that rational debate has gone out. And I thought that was sort of most interesting sort of last May, June, when we were sort of in the early stages of lockdowns and pandemics. And what the interesting thing was in Europe was that there was no real interest in analyzing the experiments of other countries. You know, there was no real interest in, Sweden is doing it differently, Denmark is doing it differently, Serbia is doing it differently, Estonia. Oh, what are they doing? Let's see if we can learn of that. Oh, what damage is being done? What are the benefits? There was none of that. It was just sort of mindless shouting, often by supposed social scientists, often by supposed empirical economists, as to, oh no, they obviously are doing the wrong thing. You know, they're showing how incredibly stupid it is not to do exactly what we have just done. Right? And in that sense, that lack of interest also among the general population, among social scientists, as to these other experiments in order to learn from what would work and what would not, showed you that something very weird was going on. This was more than just a couple of people making a career out of shouting apocalypse. There was also a group phenomenon going in. There was sort of a desire to believe that everybody else was stupid and that whatever we'd done was the right thing, and no wish to analyze that. It was kind of like, we're in the herd, we're stampeding very nicely, very much. Don't bother us with actual facts. And many countries are still not out of that. We're still in this kind of, you know, some people have described it as psychosis. I think it more of crowd behavior. But it is a very odd phenomenon whereby there's this deliberate, I don't want to know. I don't want to sort of truly think widely and sort of, you know, have my position at least put in perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I've dug up this guy's track record. In 2001, 6 million farm animals were slaughtered based on his predictions. In 2002, he said 50,000 people would die from BSE. 177 died. In 2005, he went up three orders of magnitude and he said bird flu would kill 200 million people. It killed 282 people, so he was off by a million fold. And in 2009, he estimated the swine flu would kill 60,000 people in the UK. It killed 457. And yet, as you say, you know, he continues to get a job and he continues to get heard. And I think what's truly astonishing is, you know, you mentioned this period of June when you would have thought, you know, supposedly this whole thing was 2 weeks to flatten the curve. You'd think, you know, 2 weeks later, all right, let's look at the countries that did this and the countries that didn't, and we could draw some conclusions. In fact, I remember I saw a paper, and I'm ashamed to say that one of the co-authors of the paper was my colleague in my postgraduate studies at Columbia. And this paper argued that lockdowns had saved 200 million lives. This was published something in June. And it was empirical work. And guess
That's
what?
not empirical work.
Well,
that's something very smelly, you know, baked up and
well, I think you can't argue with the methodology, because what they did was they looked at the actual number of people who died over those couple of weeks or months, and then they compared it to Niall Ferguson's models. And so they found, oh wow,
We've saved them.
we've saved
I know. Look,
we've saved the town from the wolf.
I know. It's exactly from the non-existent wolf in that sense. Yeah, certainly not a wolf that big. But it's been a real shame of sort of top science in general, right? And particularly the medical journals. I mean, The Lancet has behaved just horrendously in publishing study
Yes.
after study, which exactly pulls that trick, which basically says, ah, oh, you know, let's look at what would have happened hadn't we done what we did, and compare that with you know, what actual died, and hence that's comparing these outlandish prediction numbers, which they keep on putting in their models, versus what happened, and say, oh, that's how much we saved. And they do that trick in many different ways. Just to say, oh, you know, we could have had as low as New Zealand if only would have done exactly as New Zealand did, which was, you know, you sort of siphon off the country, go to the middle of the ocean somewhere, and then wreck your own economy, wreck your own health service. Not count all the deaths from the wrecked health service, not look at all the miserableness and all the problems coming in the future. Let's just only look at a tiny bit, you know, a hundredth of all the damage that's done. And they say, well, that tiny bit is what we could have had, and none of the rest, right? And it's insane. It
It's
really is
absolutely
such,
insane.
it's like science has left the door, right?
It really
But,
is.
you know, there are always green shoots of recovery. I mean, I couldn't believe it when this was happening, but it has opened my eyes and many of my colleagues as well. It's sort of, wow, this is apparently the age we now live in. It's like a dark age in some sense.
It really is. I think, you know, we grow up listening to stories about how people used to go mad in crowds before, and, you know, a town would go crazy and they'd burn a witch because, you know, she prescribed a herb to someone that didn't quite work. And we think, you know, those people are crazy. Burning witches isn't going to work. And yeah, it's just a
And
global
here we
witch burning.
are.
It's amazing. On a global scale, it's the first mass hysteria that was happening on a global scale. I'd never imagined we could see it, but there it is. You know, Twitter and social media allowed this hysteria to scale in an absolutely insane way.
I think that's very true, that we're seeing the effect of sort of the connectedness of the world. And also it shows many other things. And one of the things it shows that implicitly the respect that the West has got for China, because a country that you truly don't respect, you truly laugh at their policies. But what happened in Italy, what happened in Denmark, which was also an early adopter of these lockdowns, was that they looked at China and Wuhan and thought, hey, yeah, we could do that. You don't say that if the beggar at the street say you lock down. You do that if somebody who actually respects locks down. And so it also, in a strange way, show that China is part of the League of Nations. It is now part of the countries taken seriously. If China does something, the rest does pay attention. And it might not have seemed that way before, but it was clear then.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the angle of China idolization was absolutely astounding. And of course, you know, let's not forget, I think in retrospect, if I were to identify two things that were particularly the most driving of hysteria, it was Niall Ferguson's models, and I think those videos from Wuhan of people dropping dead in the street. I think that made a lot of people I know lose their minds. I think I saw those people, and after they saw those videos, they were just completely batshit crazy. They'd lost their minds. You know, I knew a person, you could talk to them, and now they saw that video, and you were talking to a complete moron now. This is just an absolute idiot who cannot think, cannot use their brain, and all they see is, oh my God, death is staring us at the door. And, you know, there's never been anything like this. There's never been a respiratory disease that just hits people in the street and drops them dead.
No, it's very fishy, very fishy. One has to presume that those things were manufactured in some sense, you know, fake news to a certain degree, definitely. And I agree, we've never seen something like this on a worldwide scale. But of course, we've seen whole countries going nuts. I mean, that, you know, history has documented hundreds and hundreds of cases of that. So we've seen it, but not at this scale. This is, you know, all the adults have left the building, basically, kind of moment.
Yeah, and in your book, you discuss the madness of crowd. You have a long section on the madness of crowd. So, can you tell us a little bit more about what you think of this phenomenon of madness of crowds? What defines a crowd? Why they're crazy?
So in our book, we agonized over in terms of understanding what had happened and understanding it in some sense of, you know, what happened to the herd of humanity, and particularly then what happened within countries. And we noted a couple of things that happened in almost each of those countries, which you've already sketched somewhere, which is, you know, an unwillingness to look at what actually might be good for health, an unwillingness to even see what has been damage close by, a sort of an extreme focus on something very small, a willingness to engage in group crimes, which is, you know, lock up the elderly, destroy the livelihoods of young people by not allowing them to go to school and socializing them, making lots of people lonely by but just making it impossible for them to meet other people, closing down businesses and hence destroying their whole careers, all the things that they've worked for in life. And so then we came to the conclusion, okay, some sort of strange group phenomenon is going on here. And then we went back into the sociological literature of, you know, a while back. So we've thought of Gustave Le Bon, we sort of Elias Canetti, Adorno is sort of one of the big names. And there were many people who wrote on these kind of phenomena 50, 100 years ago, of course, partly after the Second World War, but also, you know, 18th, 19th century people like Charles Mackay, who just saw whole villages going mad, as you said, but also of werewolves, if, you know, they were afraid of vampires, witches, as you said, or trolls in the mountains, or, you know, the doomsday was coming. And they analyzed those places as if indeed they went mad. And when we read those descriptions, it was kind of like, oh, that's exactly how it looks like, right? And so then we sort of distilled that for the modern age. And one of the things is that a quintessential aspect of the crowd is this obsession with something small, right? And in that obsession with something small, all the other stuff sort of loses its significance. It's as if the small thing to the group becomes enlarged as kind of this hugely important thing, and it crowds out care for their kids, it crowds out care for their own career. I mean, you know, it crowds out care for jobs, for sort of long-term health and futures. It becomes this all-consuming obsession of a group, and that's one of the things, right? And the second thing that then happens is that group, as it were, it loses its empathy, it loses, as it were, a fixed moral compass, and becomes totally fluid, both in terms of truth, because everything starts to, you know, come together in terms of what can we do about this obsession, how can we get what we obsess about. But that also filters through to morality. So good and bad start to sort of lose its meaning over time and start to be about, good is controlling this virus or, you know, solving this obsession in some sense, and bad is not doing that, right? So everything else that used to be good or bad before, or that will be good or bad again in 10 years' time, sort of fade away almost as moral constructs. And people sort of then, you know, start to look weirdly. And with that, hence, comes this willingness to, as a group, become criminals, you know, truly cause the deaths of millions of people. And of course, we've seen this during the COVID panic as well, inside countries, you know, what we've done to our own children, what we've done to lonely people, what we've done to people in nursing homes, what we've done to people in hospitals is just awful. The destruction has been on a totally different magnitude than anything to do with COVID itself. But we've also been willing to do this to other countries. So one of the things I say to my fellow economists is, well, look at, you know, what the disruption of trade, what the disruption of sort of normal social interaction has done in poor parts of the world where they don't have all the extras that we have. You know, if we impoverish ourselves and become only half as rich as we were, we'll still be fine. But that's not true in India. That's not true in the slums there. You lock up people there in 3 weeks, well, they've got no food. They're just going to die out of hunger, right? And of course, that happened, but then it's sort of called COVID after the fact. And
It's tragic. It's
it's
amazing.
tragic, it's tragic. But the big thing is, they don't want to know. They don't want to see, right? It's kind of like, it's not my problem, right? It's, oh yeah, but if they weren't obsessing with COVID, then, you know, hundreds of millions would have died. They instantly fantasize a bigger number to do with their own obsession, which then justifies it. And that's like becoming you know, a genocidal criminal in some sense, right? They just don't care at that moment. And that is fascinating, that they could have been development economists working their whole lives on that, and suddenly it's all jettisoned overboard. You know, their desire to be with the herd is such that they just pretend not to see, right? And it's
This was absolutely fascinating for me because I did development economics in LSE. I did my master's degree in development economics in LSE, and then my PhD was in sustainable development. So I'm very familiar with the literature. I spent many years reading this stuff. And I remember, you know, the economists would very meticulously, particularly the empirical economists, would very meticulously study for many years the impact of tiny little obscure policies. You know, when Senegal passed the law that, you know, changed, say, something about school meals, what was the impact? They'll study the impact 5 years later, what it did to brain development, what it did to IQ scores, what it did to incomes. They'll study these, not just 5 years, you know, they'll study these kids 20 years later, and they'll get massive amounts of funding to look at the impact of such tiny little obscure policies on one village or one country. And somehow, locking down the entire country just was, common sense. Obviously, it has to happen, it has to be done, and therefore everybody just goes along with it. It's absolutely amazing.
It is absolutely stunning, and I've been very, very disappointed that many of my colleagues, particularly at sort of the top universities, but I will say the LSE, relative to many other universities, has been reasonably good at this. So the well-being economists, at least in the UK, have almost unanimously been against lockdowns, or at least suggested important alternatives, and have spoken out. So Paul Dolan, is now part of Collateral Global, and he speaks out against this. Richard Layard is a big well-being guy. He wrote against this also in the British Medical Journal. He was standing up to be countered. Andros Ordnick Poverty, they wrote pieces saying, well, you know, shouldn't we actually just give people information about the risks, and then they would make their own choices rather than imposing things. So in a way, the well-being economists, and particularly as were some of the LSE crowd, have been relatively good. But as an institution, or even the majority of economists, oh my God, have we failed, right? I mean, there's
it's
a mass failure.
The international institutions, you know, the aid organizations and the World Bank and all of these, it's absolutely astounding what a dereliction of duty it was. But go back, I want to discuss the career stuff, the career impacts of that, and like the professional aspect. But I want to go back to the madness of crowds. From your studies, how do people snap out of this? Like, how does the village eventually, or does the village eventually ever come to terms with the fact that, you know, this old lady we burnt was just an old lady, and maybe we should stop burning old ladies? Or, you know, do just the people who burned her die, and their kids forget about it, and then two generations later they burn another one?
Well, it's more the latter one. So there are various ways in which a crowd comes to an end, right? So one is that if the crowd misbehaves too much and makes too much of a nuisance to other people, so that could be a neighboring village, it could be a neighboring country whom they invade, but in some ways, you know, start a large war, which means there's a huge counter reaction, and they get conquered, then the conqueror sorts it out. You know, the conqueror basically takes the leaders, shoots them, hangs them, or in some way makes an example of them, and then just floods the media of the conquered country with counter-propaganda. So we've seen
That's a happy ending of sorts.
That's
I guess.
Reasonable happy ending, but after a devastating war. So that was Nazi Germany, but that was also Japan, right? And that's many instances also of villages which were snapped out of it by, just as it were, authorities coming into the village and say, right, you guys have gone so mad on this vampire stuff. You've created so much trouble in the neighborhood. We're just going to go in here. We're going to, you know, hang the head man of the office. And we are going to bombard you every week with sermons as to how there are no vampires, right? And so that's one way. Basically, the group makes such, as it were, damage, and damages the interests of others, that they come in and sort it out. Now, that, of course, only happens if you really make a nuisance of things, because you are then forcing others to go and fight you and conquer you, right, and then try and sort you out. So another way in which the madness of crowds comes to an end is that the crowd gradually loses interest. You know, because you can obsess about vampires, but come on, I mean, you also want a career, you want to get married, you might want to travel. I mean, there are other things to worry about than these bloody vampires in the neighborhood. And the same thing, of course, for the Prohibition, the same thing for people were Puritans or socialists. People don't just care about one thing. So that obsession sort of starts to fizzle out at the edges of the crowd. But it doesn't happen in the Big Bang. There's no sort of moment of revelation of, oh, we were wrong. It doesn't usually happen that way unless someone forces them into that. So yeah. It is more that other concerns come in. So it fades. That's what happens. But the fading can take a long time. It can take years.
I think we're beginning to see some of that happen with the vaccination. I think for a lot of the crazies, the vaccine served as the kind of, this is the ending point. Like this is it. You know, they sacrificed a year of their life waiting for the vaccine. And then when they took the second dose, they just basically snapped out of it. They were ready to go back to attend concerts. They were ready to start living normally. And so you started seeing many of the people that, you know, I saw on Twitter completely losing their mind in March 2020. By, say, June 2021, you started, you know, with the summer coming in and with the second vaccine shot, a lot of them started acting a little bit more reasonable and started being more critical of these authorities and these measures. So I guess perhaps that might be the case, yeah.
Look, I totally agree that you do see as it were people with a zest for life snapping out of the bit, but the beast is not dead yet, right? I mean, this kind of, you know, coalition of interests which wants to keep it going will find ways to keep it going. They still control the airwaves. So it will be, you know, COVID flares up again. We need a booster shot and that makes billions and everybody needs to be tested. That makes other people billions. Keep people at home. That makes whole industry billions at the expense of, you know, more hands-on shops. And so there is this huge commercial drive to sort of keep the madness going. And that does not fade slowly. Well, it doesn't fade fast, you know, and we're not done with that yet. So what more likely sort of kills it off quicker is partially this realization, booster and then another booster, and we're still not done with this, so that people get tired of this, right? But also jealousy of other places which are living normally and living happily. I mean, I see the beaches of Florida, and I want to live in Florida, right? And it's that kind of, you know, almost animalistic. Look, life is good there. They're not dying in hordes. You know, I want to be there. I want my kids to live there. I want to live life unencumbered again. I think that force, it will be, as it were, the strongest opponent of this madness. Because, of course, you can't really keep people from migrating to places where life is better. So I think more people will want to go and live in Sweden, Denmark. I mean, the whole of Scandinavia has now seen sense. You know, Estonia might see more people coming in. Serbia, of course, within the states, the southern states are sort of more sensible. And in every continent, there are places which are more sensible. And you'll just see people migrating there. You'll see them staying there for long holidays, businesses moving there. You see that quite a bit already. And that kind of competition and jealousy, that snaps us out of it slowly, because there's nothing that convinces people more than sheer jealousy. You know, they won't understand the science, they won't mind the propaganda, but seeing other people have a good time and not having a good time yourself, that's horrible. You know, that hurts. And so that makes you snap out of it, I think.
That's very good. I think those of us who are living our lives normally need to start flaunting it more.
Absolutely. You're doing a service.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Post the pictures.
Yeah. But, you know, it's astounding. So I remember, like, when this whole thing started, I know nothing about Belarus. I've never followed Belarus as a country. I know one person from Belarus. I have a friend who's married to a Belarusian woman. I've met her two times. That I have no connection with the country, but I remember that the president said, yeah, we're not doing any of this bullshit. Go to the sauna and drink vodka. That's how we handle it here in Belarus. And in my mind, this was absolutely fascinating. You know, there is the control group. I thought all of the world's economists would jump on Belarus to see what's going to happen. I thought this was fascinating. And I have a thread on Twitter, which I've been following for a year and a half, and I keep updating the thread every time there's notable news on Belarus. You know, when it first happened, I posted, I said, all right, there we go. We've got the control group. And, you know, they were even more stark than Sweden, because Sweden still banned crowds and they still did a bunch of restrictions. But Belarus, the dictator said, we're not doing any of this stuff. The churches were still going, marketplaces were still open. football games were still open, and I follow football, so I was following the Belarusian league because there was no more football anywhere in the world.
Desperate for a game.
Yeah, I started following the Belarusian league, and you could see, you know, there were people in the stands, and the players were turning up every week. And next week, the same players turn up. You know, they didn't die. There was no plague that was killing all the players, and the whole league went through, and they played the whole league. You know, they had like a couple of games that were postponed because a couple of players tested positive, but they played their whole season regularly. They had their military parades. They had then, you know, during the summer, they had an attempt at an overthrow of Lukashenko. So you had the biggest crowd in the history of Belarus. There was something like a million people in the streets of Minsk. And that, so all of that was happening all throughout the summer, you know, March and then June and all of that going on. And it was astounding how few people wanted to even look at it. Everybody was just saying, well, you know, it's Belarus, it's a dictatorship, you can't believe anything. No, you can't not believe the fact that the football league is still going on. You know, if this is as deadly as you say it is, those players would be dead by now. The thousands of people turning up to watch the cup final would have died. You know, they wouldn't be back again next week to watch their team in the league. And yet, absolutely nobody had any interest in it. And it's...
Which is fascinating, that unwillingness to sort of even expose oneself to sort of information which would take you out of the mass, out of the crowd, is amazing. But I don't know much about us as Belarus as you, but one of my favorites was in Tanzania, where the president was also saying, look, this is all bollocks, we shouldn't be afraid of this. And he had a papaya and a goat test positive for COVID. I thought that was fantastic. You know?
Yes.
I don't care if it's a marketing stunt. It's kind of like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and it absolutely is. And I want to get to the PCR test and the science aspect of it, but I wanted to just, you know, on the jealousy aspect of it, this thing, you know, you'd think, all right, well, Belarus, you can dismiss Belarus. And then South Dakota started being normal, and people continue to dismiss South Dakota because, you know, most people think, don't really believe South Dakota exists. It's just kind of a hole in the middle of the U.S. for many people. They just, you know, it doesn't exist. And then Sweden just went completely, almost completely back to normal, and then people continue to dismiss it. And then Florida went normal, and then Texas went normal. And it's absolutely amazing for the average citizen of, you know, blue states in the U.S. This is just, these are all non-existent facts. You know, these are facts that exist outside the Overton window. To the extent that they are processed at all, it's that Lukashenko is a dictator who's murdering his people. DeSantis is a dictator who's murdering his people. Abbott is a dictator who's murdering the people of Texas, you know, with complete disregard to the numbers. And, you know, just, you can very easily come up with these rationalizations. Well, you know, obviously they're cooking the numbers and they're hiding the bodies, and DeSantis is feeding the bodies to the alligators of Florida.
Yeah, too many Bond films, mate. No, look, I agree. The stories people tell themselves are amazing, but the U.S. is an interesting place. I mean, it's a place where people say to their opponents that they're mad and that they're sort of cooking the books and this and that. But you know what? They do look at the success of other places. And the success of South Dakota was at least copied by the other Republican states, and quite a few of them, right? Because the Republican governors were, of course, fully on board with the COVID madness at the start as well. You know, I mean, Trump also sort of, you know, gave free rein to the CDC to go and lock down things. So that they were on board with this stuff, but at least they switched when they saw one of their own do something different, and that worked out. So there is, as it were, learning from each other experiments. And the thing about Florida and Texas is that, yes, they're sort of derided more in the Democratic states, but you know what? The businesses are moving. And when people want to have a good time, they want to go and marry, have a party, they congregate where? In Miami, you know, so the beaches are full. And so in a way, you know, watch the feet, you know, don't watch the rhetoric, because America in that sense is, you know, the airwaves are always full of superlatives. But you just watch the flow, watch the money, watch the people go. And it's sort of, okay, people are starting to suss out that, you know what, New York is not working, right? New York is emptying. Another place is another place to be. And that does not get unnoticed in the U.S. You know, no amount of bullshit can hide that.
Yes, although I guess the downside to that is that some of these people, they will move to Texas and to Florida, but they will take their politics with them, and they will vote in the next election to bring their politics, because this has just become identity and ideology in an absolutely astounding way that I never imagined I could see. Like, for
True.
we have to lock down, because otherwise Trump would have been right at some point in his
Yeah,
presidency.
I know. I've had friends make that argument. I kind of like, is that what matters to you? Whether some politician is right or wrong? Isn't it what matters to you? Your kids? The health of your nation? And their sort of their answer seems to be no. I want Trump to be wrong no matter what. But I tell you what, I do think COVID is the remaking of the Republicans, right? I mean, I have no skin in the game. I don't vote in America. I don't particularly like any of the politicians there. But I do think that this is really rejuvenating the Republican Party. It almost makes them the party of the workers. I mean, it's like they flipped positions. Left wing and right wing have sort of flipped positions in the U.S. As a result of this pandemic, and so you now see, even coming out of their think tanks, pieces which would be unheard of years ago, coming out of these Republican think tanks about wages and inequality, and we must tackle the big firms. And it's kind of like, I'm sorry, have the Republicans gone left wing all of a sudden? But it's just a reversal of politics. It's just sort of, the Democrats have taken over the big tech agenda and are sort of suppressing the workers. And the Republicans have sort of shifted there because, well, that's where the votes now are. And it's amazing to see.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Of course, one underlying theme of this podcast, and in my first book, The Bitcoin Standard, and my forthcoming book, The Fiat Standard, which is going to be out in a few weeks, is the idea that with fiat money, the concept of opportunity cost is obliterated. And I think this whole COVID panic was a great illustration of this, because when you have a government that can print money, then you simply destroy the concept of opportunity cost in most people's minds. People just don't think of things as having a cost, because if the government passes a law that says everybody stays home and gets a check for $1,000 a week, well, then there's no cost to this. Then we can do it. We have a responsibility. We have a printer. We can use it, and we can save lives. And so, if you decide that you don't want to use the printer, in which basically runs for free, you make $1,000 for free, then you're just, for no good reason, you're deciding that you just want to kill people. And I think this is really, in my mind, why I find this such a fascinating topic from the perspective of a Bitcoiner and somebody who's interested in how fiat money works. This is, the fruits of fiat. This is just the idea that we have this fake money that the government can just create, which turns money from an accounting system for value creation, for subjective value, for people who what they value and exchange with one another, into a government brownie point system, into a system of allocating favors based on the government, based on the government's goodwill, basically. And that's allowed these governments to just carry out all these insane policies with little regard for the cost. And I think now, in economics, things don't just play out over a week or two. We had a lot of people declare victory saying, oh, no, look, we stopped the world economy for a few months and we didn't have hyperinflation. We didn't have mass starvation in rich countries. And therefore, you see, we've saved lives. And now things are fine. But now we're beginning to see, inflation is rising, unemployment is still very high, the labor market is not really recovering as it would have, and a lot of people are still living off of government paychecks. And I think, we're only beginning to see the reckoning come right now. But of course, by the time it comes about, fiat politicians will print a whole bunch of money and will also find other new scapegoats to blame this on.
Oh, definitely. There will be, as it were, a new story as to why the problems that were really created by all this extra borrowing and, as you say, effectively money printing will be the fault of something else. That's how politics always works. They will always find an additional reason rather than their own mismanagement. Definitely. But there are many things to say about what you just said. One is, of course, that there have been huge damage inside Western countries, which have been well documented, even inside bureaucracies. but both politicians and a large part of the population just haven't wanted to see. But you cannot disrupt the schooling of a whole generation of kids and not have enormous consequences, you know, immediately on their mental health, immediately on their ability to socialize, the long-run human capital, long-run taxation possibilities, but even just you know, their sense of humanity, their relationships with their grandparents, who now suddenly are in this fearful relationship whereby they see each other as were potential killers of each other, rather than the warm relationships they should have been enjoying. And meanwhile, of course, many of the grandparents have gone demented. But there is something else to be said about this. It has been an amazing experiment in terms of, you know, how much money can we print and get away with it. But I don't think they will get away with it, because money, in a certain sense, and particularly when it's printed, is like a call on people's time. So it is a little bit of the least understood of economics tricks, right? It is a means of exchange. It's a means of exchanging time. And so it's also grabbing time of people. Now, time remains totally fixed resource. So, you know, one way or another, you cannot just, as it were, print more time. And if you print the intermediary of time, then basically you're putting pressure on the trust of that intermediary. And particularly in an open system, which our economies still are, there's still trade with other countries, you're effectively, as we're abusing the trust that people have put in that currency and invested in sort of decades. And so, yeah, sure, we're going to see inflation, but we're also going to see all kinds of other things, which is people, corporations are going to look for other kinds of money and see, well, okay, I want to safeguard the value of the money that I have. And hence not have something in the currency that governments can just print shitloads more of. And I think in that sense, we're in for a wild monetary ride. And of course, you know, you being on the Bitcoin side, I'm hoping the Bitcoin will take that over. But I think that there'll be a whole conga line of competitors coming, right? Whereby it's kind of like, whoa, if it's this easy to take time of other people, which is really what has happened with this money printing, I want in too. And so it'll be the Wild West, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're describing one of the central theses of the Bitcoin standard, which is the idea that Bitcoin, you know, the only thing that is truly scarce is human time. All other resources, as Julian Simon used to say, time, human time is the ultimate resource, because with human time, we can make more of everything. You know, we can dig for more gold, more oil, more zinc, more copper. We're never going to run out of those things. The earth contains far too much for us to ever exploit. It's only a matter of time. How much time can we dedicate to them versus other things? So really the only scarcity is the scarcity of time. And that's why people look for a money that is scarce, because that's how you store the fruits of your time. Mm-hmm. And in this regard, you know, Bitcoin is the is in my mind the natural winner of this race, the inevitable winner, because it's the only one whose supply cannot be expanded. There'll never be more than 21 million Bitcoins. Mm-hmm. With all other forms of money, you know, whoever has a way of making that money will always find a way of making more of it, whether it's a government printing its money, whether it's gold miners looking for gold or silver miners looking for silver, or other digital currencies, the people behind them being able to create more of them. There's always a way to make more. But with Bitcoin, you know, the mold has been broken. We can't make more. That's really what differentiates
I'm not so convinced of that. But are you sure we want to have a fight on Bitcoin in this program? I sort of don't want. I want to remain friends on this.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I think we can. Here's the thing. Like we had discussed before this. We discussed Paul and I having half of this on COVID and then one half on Bitcoin. But I think there's so much to cover on COVID. We'll do the Bitcoin discussion some other time. We'll have you over maybe next week and we'll discuss Bitcoin at length. But
I think that would be a good thing. Exactly. I have some difficult questions for you too, as part of the Bitcoin community.
Sounds great. I think it'll make for a very good discussion. You know, we have an empirical economist who's skeptical, and then you know, I'm going to try and see if I can win you over. Definitely. By the end of it. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to COVID for now. So I want to talk a little bit more about the scientific. Well, about the lockdown before we get to the scientific stuff. What is the evidence for the effectiveness of lockdown? You look into that in the book. And what do you
think? Oh, definitely. Definitely. So the key thing to say is that pre-March 2020, there was effectively no evidence for lockdowns at all when it came to endemic diseases. And endemic diseases are, you know, those which are so broad in the human stream that you're never going to get rid of them. And so then the thinking was that, well, you might be able to suppress it and keep it out of a city, for instance. You know, if you block all roads in and out, you will be able to keep it out to some degree for some time, but you're never going to keep it out indefinitely. It's going to walk in via animals eventually, even if you sort of, you know, stop all humans, right? And so the evidence from before March 2020 was that they're sort of nonsense, right? When it comes to a sort of a highly infectious endemic disease, it's too late, basically. The horse has bolted. And then on
by the time you figured out that it's there, then it's already in transmission. And if you lock people up, then you're just letting it fester at homes.
Yes, and that's, as it were, this moment of endemic, right? So with the SARS epidemic, it was slightly different because it was less infectious. It was more easy to see who had it. And so there was still a chance to nip it in the bud. In that sense, you know, SARS, MERS were kind of like the showcases of how, if it's not yet, as it were, spread widely over the world, you have a chance, you know, via, as it were, localized lockdowns as they had in Hong Kong, you know, to stop it from spreading and sort of, you know, contain it. But for COVID, that was way too late, already in February, right? Because it was way too infectious. And of course, lots of people were running around who had it, who didn't know they had it. And there was a huge multiple that didn't know they had it and were running all over the world versus those who were sort of, you know, very symptomatic. And so you could see that they had it. When it then came to whether or not the lockdowns work, I was an empirical scientist. I was on the fence. It was kind of like, okay, well, if these epidemiologists and virologists say this would have a chance, I initially went along with that. I was immediately against lockdowns because I knew of the collateral damage. You know, that's sort of my expertise. I'm a well-being economist. I knew how damaging this would be to well-being, to mental health, to the children. I knew what this would do to our sort of our human rights. I knew what this would do to developing countries. So, and I could quickly calculate that was going to be way worse. So from a cost-benefit point of view, there was sort of, you know, hands down, this is stupid anyway. But I was on the fence as to whether or not lockdowns would work. And then if you look purely empirically at the countries which have had the greatest number of COVID deaths, let's say in Europe, where the virus have effectively, you know, gone round totally, nobody stopped it getting in their borders, then all the top countries, you know, with maybe one or two exceptions in the top 30, they're all heavy lockdown places. And they have neighbors which are not heavy lockdown places. So you can compare Denmark to Germany, or you can compare Serbia to Hungary. And it's always the no lockdown places which have less deaths than their, you know, heavy lockdown neighbors. And so just from that, you should sort of think, well, okay, how can lockdowns kill, right? What is going wrong with the lockdowns that they even kill more people of COVID? And one thing is, of course, that they reduce your immune system. You know, locking people inside their homes so that they don't have a social relationship is bad for their immune systems. They then also don't exercise much. They don't get out and have vitamin D via the sun. They're not motivated to look after themselves, so their diet deteriorates, they drink more alcohol, more chocolate, and they basically become less healthy. And so then they become more susceptible. So we've seen this in many countries as well, and the UK is a great example of this. That several months after initial lockdowns, particularly in the winter of 2021, you see this huge increase, right? It's as almost as if the population had been softened up by the lockdowns to be more susceptible to this. And so empirically, particularly in regions where you know it's sort of gone round totally, it's the lockdown places which have done worse. If you look over the world as a whole and divide the countries into, you know, heavy lockdowns in 2020 versus no lockdowns or more pragmatic kind of policies, then you see that, as it were, the less restrictive the groups of countries, the less average numbers of COVID deaths. We don't even need to look at excess deaths or other things, because on those metrics, it's way worse still. Because, of course, you know, lockdowns disrupt the health system as a whole. And so people start dying a little bit later, but things that weren't picked up, like cancers, like, of course, diabetes, which is then not addressed, and all kinds of other illnesses, which you sort of need to monitor and be on top of, lest they start to kill off members of the population. So empirically, if you compare the high lockdown countries or regions in the world with the low lockdown countries, particularly in the neighborhood, you either see nothing or you see perversely that the greater the lockdown, the worse the outcomes in terms of COVID deaths.
Yeah, it seems like an inescapable conclusion when I look at it. I mean, I said this, as I was mentioning earlier, with Belarus. I said this in, I think, March of 2020. I said, all right, we'll compare Belarus with its five neighboring countries
It was Poland, Ukraine, Russia, Lithuania, and a couple more. And I think there's one more. It was five, I think. I don't have them in front of me right now. But 1 year later, I ran the numbers on this, and Belarus had the lowest mortality, the lowest number of COVID deaths, and the lowest number of excess mortality if you looked at numbers. And in fact, I think the most interesting fact of it is that, you know, maybe it's a little bit, even if it were a little bit lower, the most indisputable thing is that it's indistinguishable from previous years everywhere else. That's the thing. I'm in
Exactly. It's
fact.
not this Armageddon. It's not the Neil Ferguson Armageddon, and that should be the killer argument, which is, look, it's impossible to deny all the negative effects. You know, you close schools, you're going to be creating problems for a whole generation of kids. You know, some are able to keep on learning, but many don't because they don't have laptops at home. You're going to lock up the elderly in old age homes without them getting visited. They're going to get demented quicker. We know this. You're going to close the hospitals for regular visits. Then you're going to get more and more cancers over time. You're going to get all kinds of other diseases. So that is not really in dispute. And then if you don't get this, as it were, you know, we've solved Armageddon because of lockdowns, that should be it. And so it was sort of like the intellectual argument was done in sort of June of last year when we didn't see Armageddon going up in Sweden and the few other countries which didn't lock down. That was sort of like, okay, well, they didn't get the nightmare scenario. Why are we still doing this? You know, it wasn't even interesting anymore, scientifically speaking, what we should be doing. Then it became a question of what the hell is going on? Why are we still locked into this?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And it's very, very difficult to come up with satisfactory answers for it. What do you think? Why are we still locked into this insanity?
That's what the crowd chapter is all about, right? Is that partially we've got this coalition of people who are now making money out of it, who have grabbed more power as a result of this. So good old-fashioned self-interest. And I am an economist in that sense. You know, follow the money is always good advice when it comes to strange phenomena. You know, who is making money out of this? Well, the people who make the masks, the people who make the tests, the people who sell the vaccines. But also, of course, lots of internet companies who sell everything via online rather than actual stores. So, you know, the online companies are more in favor of that. The ones who do, as it were, business via the online regulations, like the Ubers, they're in favor of this. The Amazons are in favor of this. Governments like this because it's a control thing, right? So their span of control in that sense has increased in the sense that they just have more control mechanisms. They like this. The medical establishment like this. You know, they sort of become virtual gods, and so that is a beast which has got hold of it, and they've managed to sort of, you know, whip the population up into these kind of maniacal crowds. But here's the problem for these profiteers. Maniacal crowds are very fickle beasts. You know, they are wild things. You know, we've seen in history that that can lead to wars or sort of, you know, concentration camps or civil wars, and tremendous violence towards the own leaders if they don't are not seen to come out with the goods. So they're on a wild ride now, and that can, of course, go in all kinds of directions. Now, we do think it'll fade, but leaders in that sense and this coalition of profiteers, which are keep whipping this up for their own private gains, they're playing with fire, right? I mean, there's huge anger that may come for them. It's uncertain. I don't think so, but it's definitely a possibility.
Yeah, I mean it'll be fascinating to see what ends up happening in this regard. I mean I imagine there would be a lot more backlash by now, but we haven't had any yet. So it'll be it's I don't know, man. People just like their TVs. I mean, it's amazing. In 2019, I thought TV was dead, and 2020 was. It's amazing. It's
The
like the
comeback of
1980s,
TV.
you know. Yeah,
It
1990s, you know.
is crazy. So in our book, The Great COVID Panic, we make a couple of historical analogies. You know, we talk about the French Revolution. We also talk about the First World War, how that ended, and how finally the war industries got wound down. But the best analogy we've come up with, so the best example of something like this was the prohibition in the US, whereby the US authorities and all their moralizers said, well, you know, we should make it difficult for people to drink alcohol, so they forbade the production and transportation and sale of alcohol. And this took 30 18 years before it was reversed. You know, it led to, of course, huge criminality and just lots of illegal drinking, a lot more problems, basically, in society. But it took 13 years, and it didn't end with a bang. It ended slowly. People became more and more hypocrites. And how it eventually ended is that the Great Depression came, and there was something else to worry about. And then almost on the sly, you know, everybody sort of agreed, okay, we shouldn't have had this prohibition, and we'll reverse the laws. And that's what happened. But there was no comeuppance. There was no punishment for people who destroyed whole industries or sort of, you know, the lives of sort of hundreds of thousands of people. There was just no revenge, right? And so revenge is a rare thing in history. You know, usually speaking, the damage is done and people dust themselves off and get on with it and worry about something else.
Yeah, it's sad.
Are you sure? I mean, think of it the other way. Do you really want to fight people so that you can have justice? I mean, justice is an expensive commodity, right?
There is an animalistic aspect that wants vindictiveness, but I think that's not really the issue here. The issue is we're never going to be done with this. There's always going to be respiratory illnesses, and there's always going to be mania, and there's always going to be a bunch of pathetic cowards who don't want to admit they were wrong in 2020, and so they're going to double down forever. I mean, you look at a place like Australia. Or New Zealand. You know, you look at the sociopath leaders that they have in those countries. They've gotten so much power. When you see them talking, people in Australia and New Zealand, many of them, they think their countries are normal. And I just got an invitation to go visit Australia and give a talk a few days ago. And I thought, you know, there's more chance of getting me to go to Afghanistan at this point than getting me to go to Australia. But, you know, you listen to their leaders telling people, you know, you must do this and you must do that. And you watch the police taking it out on people because they went out and exercise. And like, they're never going to snap out of this. As long as there's ever going to be anybody coughing in the country, there will be totalitarianism.
Well, I mean, I love Australians. You know, I lived there for many years and have many Australian friends. And so I hate to give up on them in such a hurry, as it were, you know, and they make good friends. But they have gone totalitarian to the max within the Western world. And they don't want to see that, you know, they've basically done all the wrong things. And they don't want to hear about it. They want to hear, you know, we've been vaccinated, the problem is solved. But look, they are also a pragmatic people. So, you know, when they have their 15th booster shot in 3 years' time, and they found out, okay, I'm now, I have half the money I had before, my kids have no education, they can also get rather angry. So watch this space with Australia. Australia might well be one of those Western countries which sort of has a near civil war in a couple of years' time. I would not be totally surprised, because yes, there are followers, they're meek, but they also can get, you know, really riled up if they feel they've been screwed over. And they have been screwed over royally, and they don't want to see it, but they're going to keep being screwed over. And so watch this space on Australia. I think we might see fireworks there.
Could be. We'll see. Okay, so the next topic I wanted to discuss was your study of the scientific substance of the disease and the PCR tests and the effect of the lockdowns. Well, we've already discussed the lockdowns, but one interesting point you mentioned is the issue of cross-immunity in your book. Mm-hmm. Tell us why you think that's a big deal and why you think the panic didn't help there.
Yes. So cross-immunity is important because, of course, cross-immunity applies to lots and lots of viruses which go around in the human stream. So one of the reasons why we don't die of influenza is because many times in our lives we've had diseases like the influenza which goes around, and we get some immunity even of our mother, right, of her immune system when we're very, very young. And the fact that people around us have had influenza protects us a little bit from further waves as well. So we only get hit by several of them. So cross immunity is a normal thing. It's sort of like, you know, viruses that look like the ones we're having now have protected us because we went ill from them in the past. And of course, the latest coronavirus is the fifth major version of it. There are four other versions which go around, and they're more prevalent in some parts of the world than other parts of the world. And they basically, by and large, seem to have originated from the Chinese region. So the closer you are to that region, probably the more exposed you've been to various coronaviruses in the past. And so probably there's more, as it were, prior levels of immunity there to this later coronavirus, which is, you know, you at least can see pretty clearly in the data that that whole area has a much lower lethality of this disease than a region which is very far away from the Chinese centered world, if you like, and also has very few people of sort of Chinese migration in the last couple of generations, like Latin America, where the number of deaths is much, much higher of this disease than it is in Africa or almost anywhere in Asia. And so I was very interested early on, you know, already in April, May, it's sort of, okay, well, let's measure this cross immunity. Let's see where it's bigger and let's see what effect that has. And again, this huge surprise that very little of the scientific community was interested in this. You did have people writing about it and talking about it, saying this must be important, you know, look at these regional differences. But there's been very little money flowing into research on this. You know, it's been basically downplayed. But there have been researchers looking into it, and they are now trying to sort of, you know, systematically sample populations everywhere, see, okay, what were the previous diseases going around? What can we at least see in test tubes? How heavy is the reaction of people who haven't had this before relative to other people who look like them in other places? So it's coming, but it'll be delayed. But by and large, this means that we sort of still have to guess a little bit. You know, the hard data is not there as to how important the cross immunity is. But the story is like the one I sketch, which is effectively the closer you get to China, the more cross immunity is likely, which explains why even in places like Australia and New Zealand, which have huge Chinese diaspora, so lots of Chinese students, the lethality of this virus seems to be much less than in other places further away from the Chinese epicenter of these coronaviruses. And there was one particular study we found, which is fascinating, which was a study in Africa, which studied the dispersion of bats, which had other coronaviruses, and they linked that to how heavily affected local communities were of these coronaviruses and others. And they indeed found that kind of pattern, which was, well, if there were lots of bats close by which had carried other coronaviruses, the community there was less affected by this particular virus. And they sort of surmised that that would be an explanatory in many Asian regions as well. And they wanted to research that further. So they were sort of looking for money to help do that. So this is an ongoing hypothesis. It's likely to be a big factor, but we're not certain.
Yeah. Do you think this really explains what's been going on in the US? In China.
Yes. I think in that sense, the Chinese data has been sort of, you know, the salient aspects of the Chinese data have not been discussed widely at all. I mean, think of what happened in Wuhan, right? This is a city of 10 million people, and the final death count of the coronavirus is 5,000 on 10 million, right? So that's 0.05, which is just 1/4 of what it was, for instance, in the UK, right? And 1/10 of what it was in Peru. And you think, right, okay, well, that was in a city where this virus is unnoticed, or at least unstopped, at least by any means, then available for maybe 2 months. So it would have been widely circulating. You know, everybody would have had it, full exposure. And so no measures, 2 months, this thing goes round. And only 5,000 out of 10 million. That tells you that, okay, this thing really is much less lethal than the Neil Ferguson models would have you believe. But also, this is much lower than we see in Europe, than we see in US, than in Latin America. So if it's that non-lethal in a place without any restrictions, it must be true that basically in China, the lethality of this virus is much, much less than it is in at least most parts of Europe and most parts of the Americas. And the obvious explanatory for that is, they already had prior immunity. They just, you know, they weren't as badly affected. That must be the front running.
Yeah, I guess this does make sense. Although, I mean, there is something astounding about looking at the curves for China and the rest of the world. I mean, it's just, you know, for China, it was a couple of months and then it went down to zero and it's flatlined. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, you know, China only implemented the lockdown in Wuhan and I think two other provinces, and it was only for a couple of weeks, maybe even months, but that was it. And it's truly fascinating that Australia is still doing this insanity 19 months later. Whereas China could get away with it and eliminate the whole thing It's, you know, you combine that with the videos of people keeling over and
I can see the suspicion coming in you. But there are other things to say about China. I mean, one is, as you say, that the data on how many people died and how much COVID there's been is hard to trust for China, right? And of course, the country has a history of hiding its the gravity of what's happened there, right? In Wuhan, this would have been difficult with the eyes of the world on it. But for instance, in the Great Leap Forward, when 30 million people died, the authorities hid it. The authorities hid it from the party elders, and they hid it from the whole population, and that was 30 million deaths. So they have form when it comes to hiding statistics, if you like. But there is a statistic which is important to bear in mind, that the Chinese cities, Shanghai and some of the other big ones, they saw a huge drop in fertility in 2020. And that drop in fertility is effectively related to the lockdowns that there was in those major cities. And so that tells you that there was a huge effect on the social system. And within China, that is big, right? It's almost a halving of the number of kids. That is just huge. You know, you can't just halve the number of kids. You keep that up for a couple of generations, there's none of you left. And so it had hugely negative effects on, as it were, the social system in China itself. So don't think of the Chinese as having gotten off with no damage. You know, they've done huge damage to themselves. And I think they've realized that. You know, they're sort of trying to do countermeasures on the fertility aspect. But don't think of China as the shining story, which, you know, sort of had no deaths and then sort of, you know, push the rest of the world in order to destroy the rest of the world. I think A, the Chinese leaders are not that smart, and B, it didn't really work out that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, perhaps playing a little bit of a devil's advocate here in terms of thinking about just the degree of totalitarian control that has been installed in the rest of the world. And then when you take into account the amount of Chinese influence on a lot of these global institutions that were at the forefront of this hysteria, perhaps there was some kind of, you know, interest in pushing this in order to facilitate more and more the, you know, the Chinese social credit system and you know, the vaccine pass and all of that stuff. It is the Chinafication of the rest of the world in a sense.
Well, there is an element of Chinification, but it works in a, yeah, I think in a way that is, as it were, not as planned as one might think, right? And so the Chinese leaders are definitely interested in looking good, but particularly looking good towards the own population. So yes, there has clearly been Chinese propaganda inside whatever levers of power they had, including their financial muscle in the WHO. That's well documented. There's basically no doubt that that happened. And they also pushed the idea to the rest of the world, look, you know, be like the Chinese reaction, lockdown, that's the smart thing to do. But the core reason for that is not to sort of, you know, destroy the West. They had no idea what lockdowns would do in the West. The core idea was, if we get other people to do this, that'll make the Chinese population think we did the right thing, right? This is all for domestic consumption. This is in order to make the Chinese population think good about the Chinese leaders. And so it's much more internal politics. You know, it's not sort of, you know, evil sculpting of some sort of, you know, clever stratagem in order to destroy competition. No, they don't, you know, nobody's that smart, A, but B, it's not in their interest. You know, that's not what they think about, because of course that can backfire very spectacularly. You can sort of, you know, set up a next world war if you're seen to sort of cause trouble for other countries. This is to look good for their own population. That's the story there. They've done that. They've pushed the propaganda to the rest of the world in order to convince their own population they did the right thing.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you look at GDP growth in China. Basically, it was the only country last year that didn't suffer massively, because, you know, they shut down three provinces for a couple of months, but the rest of the country more or less operated normally. People wore masks, but internal travel was normal. I remember it was in, I think, June, where they had that big holiday in June 2020, and, you know, this was a time when we only had Belarus and Sweden to push the case. And then, you know, you got these videos of I can't remember the name of the holiday, but everybody was traveling all over China, and tourism
Yeah,
was off and
the
things were
Chinese New
normal.
Year's and this and that. Yes, it's in February.
Whereas, you know, you look everywhere else, the economic damage has been devastating.
Well, but it's not that much different. So the Chinese GDP growth of last year were, I think, 2 to 3%, but they normally have 6 to 7%. And so there was a 4% drop in GDP growth. Well, that's not too dissimilar from many places in Europe. That's roughly the drop we saw in, I think, the Netherlands, I think Germany. So I think the GDP drop there, that they were sort of were the only major country to grow, but that's because they have a very high initial growth rate. Right? They did experience a big drop in the growth rate relative to expected. And relative to the whole Scandinavian region, right? Because Sweden was the only one which didn't lock down, but relatively quickly, all the other Scandinavian countries also started to stop lockdowns. And now they're sort of like the same region in Europe. They as a whole also didn't see much more than, you know, 3-4% maybe of drop in GDP growth relative to what was expected. So as it were, the Chinese did see economic losses, but, you know, they're sort of on this spectacular growth trajectory. And so it was sort of a dip in the growth, but not yet reduction.
Okay, so then a few more issues. The PCR tests, what do you think of them?
Well, I think the PCR test, we the world as a whole would have been better off without it, I think. I mean, it's of course very inaccurate. It picks up pieces of the virus, whether dead or alive. So we could be picking up previous infections. But also it's fed this obsession, right? I mean, I just can't watch the newspapers anymore. It's always about how many tests and this and that. And these tests can be manipulated because you can make them more sensitive or less sensitive. They are a huge industry. So I also always think I'm looking at a form of corruption when, you know, testing is being made compulsory somewhere. I always think, well, you know, who's paid a politician to ensure that? And I think in effect, it's been a disaster that we've gone to a test society, which feeds this obsession. And I think one of the many lessons is that we should stop testing. We should not do this, right? We should be much more frugal with this continuous obsession with testing every aspect of our health. And so that's in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think in general, it's just this is a big, insane problem with modern medicine in general, which is, I recently discovered, this is something I intuitively had, and I recently discovered this is basically the difference between all traditional medicines and modern medicine. Traditional medicine looks at the patient and tries to see what is wrong with the patient. Modern medicine looks at the lab results. You know, there's all these tests. And so the doctor doesn't even look at you. So you tell him, all right, I have these symptoms, and he doesn't care to look at you. He functions as a bot, basically. You give him the symptoms and he orders the tests, and then he looks at the tests, and then he issues the diagnosis. And then based on the diagnosis, he issues the medicine, which is, I think, extremely problematic, because most of these tests, you know, if you really start digging into them, there's a lot of problems with them. The biggest scam test in my mind is the cholesterol, which is a huge, huge, huge industry. The biggest drug in the world, the biggest grossing drug for the pharmaceutical industry in the world. Although this was before coronavirus, so maybe the new vaccines might beat that. But statins used to be the biggest industry, or it might still be. And that's all built on the idea that your cholesterol has to be within a certain range. And you dig into that and you realize it's completely nonsense. And these examples are many. I think, you know, in many cases, if you're healthy, you know, the best thing you can do is just avoid these medical tests, because you go to a doctor, they'll order enough tests to find one that's wrong, and then they'll put you on a medicine, and that medicine will mess you up, and then he's guaranteed a lifelong customer, because you just keep creating more problems, more iatrogenics. And I think that this, with the PCR, the notion that you had healthy people forced to isolate from society, like athletes, it's amazing. For me, you know, you have all these professional athletes who are able to, you know, on Saturday, he was scoring, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo was scoring 3 goals for Juventus in Serie A. And then on Sunday, he tests positive. And then he has to miss the Champions League game, and he has to isolate for a week or whatever. And then he comes back from his isolation and he scores another 2 goals, you know. The fact that people think, you know, this man went through this illness and came back and was able to score 5 goals on either side of the illness is mind-boggling. Clearly, he wasn't ill. And if the test says he's ill, the test is broken.
Look, I agree with nearly all of that. I mean, it is also an insane conception of society, right? Whereby we're on the basis of tests, which are going to try and pick up all kinds of outlandish disease. And of course, no person running around is totally bug-free. We've got millions of viruses and bacteria in our body and on us at any moment in time. And, you know, we have lots of very, very tiny little tumors and lots of small problems at any moment in time. You test too much, then you're going to pick up 1,000 things, 900 of which you won't have, right? And 100 of things which won't be a problem, but you've got them, right? And as you say, that feeds then a medical industry. But now it's gone to the level whereby society then starts to react on that and sort of, oh, no, you've had the test and that sort of, you know, you're now excluded from society until the new test says that you're fine. It really is like the Catholic Middle Ages. It's kind of like, oh no, you know, you're of the devil. The devil has invaded you, and you should sit in the corner over there until the priest has come and sort of, you know, woven his magic wand over you and says you're fine to go now. You've done your penance. And it is not a sustainable society. It's very costly. It's very disruptive, and it's stupid. We should not be like this, right? It's not a healthy way to live. And so, and in that sense, it is amazing how dysfunctional empirical science has become, as you said at the start, right? We now see these reductions in life expectancy. And Australia is a great case in point whereby you see these excess deaths going up. And it's basically got nothing to do with COVID. It's because of this kind of mindless health obsession, which is, in fact, very unhealthy for us. But ka-ching, ka-ching, it's making money. But it's reducing our health. It's making us die younger. Lonelier, without worrying more about, you know, are we having fun in life? Are we doing good things for the rest of humanity, for our kids? And it's derailing. We should get rid of it, but it's hard to see because this is a big beast. This is a huge industry. You know, we're not gone. We're not done with this in a hurry.
No, you're absolutely correct in the analogy to the church. It's really, and you know, all of these con artists who play doctors on the internet wearing lab coats when their job is to sit and basically crunch numbers and talk to the media. It's amazing. You know, it's the priestly coat where they have to wear these customs, so that they appear like they are the priestly class, that they are above us, and they can, you know, they get on TV and they tell you that, you know, today you can go shopping for 1 hour, but only if you do this and if you do that.
Yes. That's right. We've read the signs, you know, the doves have flown in the right direction. Shopping mall in the east of town is okay, but on the west, no, they haven't paid their bribes. Sorry. I mean, it is a totally dysfunctional society that is turning into, but therein also lies my hope. I mean, we talk about this at length in the book. We say, look, this is so impoverishing. This is so bad for productivity, so bad for people's mental health that, you know, this cannot win. It's like this huge extra weight on society. And fortunately, you know, Western societies are sort of ruthless winners in the long run. We jettison what drags us down. And this is just a huge amount of bullshit which drags us down. It makes us poorer, less happy, dumber. And I think at a certain moment, we are just going to jettison it. But I'm afraid it might take a couple of years. But it is just dysfunctional stuff.
Yeah, I hope you're right. A couple of rituals from the cult of the hygiene theater that we went into these cults. So masks, what's your empirical take on the effectiveness of masks?
So I've looked at the evidence for masks, right? And I was initially on the fence. I sort of in March thought, well, what do I know? You know, maybe. And then I read a couple of studies which said, well, they don't work all that well in the clinical setting. And furthermore, these virus particles are so small that they are to masks what gates at the garden are for mosquitoes. You know, you might argue that a mosquito might bang up against part of the gate, but it's not going to stop the mosquitoes, right? It's not going to help at all, right? So my take was very early on that, look, I don't believe that they're going to have any beneficial effect, but God knows, you know, let's see if the studies come in. And so there have been a couple of big studies come in. There's, of course, the famous Danish one. Then there's the one in, is it Sri Lanka or Bangladesh, right, which I went through with a fine tooth comb. And there, my take from that study was, well, if they help at all, it's not the mask you think may help, so not the cloth ones. And to a minute degree, in villages where almost nobody has COVID and none of them seem to wear the mask correctly anyway, or at least very few. So it was kind of like, right, and this is what you've got going for it after 1.5 years, right? If you look at the empirical studies, as where have they helped regions to any degree? I haven't seen good evidence, and I've seen plenty of regions with mask mandates, and things have only gotten worse. So at my reading of the empirical evidence is, if they help, it's a very tiny amount, but from a long-run position, again, not. As soon as it's endemic, it's going to keep coming back until nearly everybody's had it, masks or no mask. And of course, I look at all the negative things about masks. You know, they're a waste mountain. They're very costly. They impede speech. They basically make people feel like second-class citizens. They're used to shut up. And what we now also see, particularly in the US, is that they've become the symbol of class. You know, it's the lower class who have to wear the mask. It's the servants who wear the class, who wear the masks. And they, you know, the masters are maskless. And so it's becoming a symbol of subjugation. You know, it's like the Star of David. It's now the mask. You know, who's the mask class? Yeah, it's the people not important enough to go around without the masks. So I find them horrible, and I find the evidence for them, you know, very uncompelling that they do more than a very tiny amount, which in an endemic situation, not very sensible either.
Yeah, and there's quite some evidence to suggest that they might actually be counterproductive. I mean, if it's a respiratory illness, obscuring or obstructing your breathing has to be the dumbest thing you could do. I mean, you spend all day breathing through dirty cloth. That's what ultimately it comes down to. And ultimately, if you can breathe in and out, then air comes in and out, then the virus is going to come in and out. It's then you know.
Exactly. And there was this French study which, you know, made the observation, look, people wear these masks for days on end, so they cough in it and they spit in it, and it's full of
Yes.
viruses and bacteria. Then they put this warm, moist thing into their pockets, you know, keeping it nice and warm and letting all the viruses breed. And then they put it back again, right? And this is supposed to be a healthy thing to do, you know. So in the way that
Yeah.
people actually use these masks, as you say, there are health risks,
I think
and plenty of evidence of that too.
that there might perhaps, you know, if you wanted to be open-minded about it, I can't completely dismiss the idea that if you had a surgical mask installed correctly and you wore it and you know the way that surgeons put it on correctly at the right in the right tightness closing it and all of that stuff, perhaps it might help to reduce. But you know, and in some of the studies where they do it in the lab setting where they put dummies and they put the masks on the dummies and then they spray and they look at it, then you see that. But of course, that's not real life. In real life, you have kids who have, you know, they make masks out of their favorite sports team and they just wear the same mask for weeks. And it's disgusting. You think, you know, this child's been breathing their own dirty snots for weeks on end. You know, you can't wash this every day. And you
No.
know, you wear the medical mask maybe for an hour during a surgery, or you wear it for something like that, and then you take it off. But people are just wearing the same dirty piece of cloth all day, every day, breathing in and out through it. It can't be good.
And that big was it Sri Lankan or Bangladeshi study, they found the cloth mask didn't help at all relative to no masks in villages. And so it was kind of like, why don't we hear that loud on the news? You know, cloth masks are useless. And again, this disinterest in, you know, actual news.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then finally, the scrubbing and spraying, all that insanity.
I know. I've just been to Wales this weekend, you know, and everywhere is sort of, you know, squirt, squirt, scissor. And I sort of refuse. And people look at me and say, don't you want to have clean hands? I sort of said, look, I want to have healthy hands. I don't want to have this, you know, alcohol taking away my peptides and sort of, you know, making my skin dry and hence making it more susceptible to be invaded by all kinds of things. I'm choosing the healthy option. None of this shit on my hands. Thank you very much. And they said, it's amazing. It's a ritual. It's kind of like, really?
And it has absolutely nothing to do with the respiratory illnesses.
No, exactly. It's kind of like, shouldn't that be up your nose? Exactly.
Yeah, no, I
But
think,
don't
you
give
know,
them ideas.
no, absolutely. No, I think, you know, there's a key point here, which is that there's a minority of people that likes to think of things in terms of consequences. And the majority, particularly when they get scared, they don't think of them in terms of the effects of the consequences. They think of them in terms of the feelings that they give you. And so People are dying, and we have to do something. And these kind of rituals are just like, you know, self-flagellation to show solidarity. You know, it's like all of these people, you know, like when there's bad things happening in the world and people change their Facebook profile pics to show solidarity, like you're not doing anything. It's not changing
that's gonna
anything.
Help.
You know? Yes, it's not going to help. You know, people have died in a flood. Go help or send money or do something. But changing your Facebook profile picture or, you know, lashing out at people who are not, you know, people that say who are carrying on with their life, you know, having a birthday party and you lash out at them. You know, people in Indonesia are dying. How could you have a birthday? There is that impulse to just, you have to punish yourself in order to show that you're a good person, that you're not letting these things happen. And I think this insanity with the masks and the scrubbing and the hand spraying, all of that stuff, I think it's just, it's the triumph of these kind of afraid, simple minds that just, it doesn't matter if it works or not. You just have to do something, you know. They get offended when you try and start a conversation about whether this is effective or not. How dare you? You know, there's that image of Greta just shouting at you, how dare you? This is kind of the mental capacity that we're dealing with, of just children who are obsessed with performing those rituals.
Look,
we could go on and on.
I know. Yeah. And I totally agree with that, but exactly what you said is one of the big things we say in this, which is that it's like a sacrificial event. And it is medieval. It is prehistoric. It is this notion of, oh, there is a problem. I'm going to solve it by hurting myself. I'm going to solve it by hurting everybody I love, my kids, my elderly, and my whole society. And that's going to solve the problem. You know, the harvest was bad. I'm going to kill my own son in the hope that next year the harvest will be good. It is like that. And we had hoped that we'd had institutions and education which would stop us from doing that kind of thing. But well, we've been shown to be wrong. You know, underlying, we're still prone to sort of believe that sacrifice will get us out of problems. And we're supposed to have institutions and governments which go against this, laws which go against this, but apparently not. They've not been strong enough to stop this kind of panic, drag us back into that kind of, you know, medieval mentality of there's a problem, we need to do something. It doesn't matter what. And of course, our societies, like you said, have always had elements of that, right? I mean, my favorite one is, what is it? Run a marathon for Africa, right? And then it's kind of like, that'll really cheer them up in Africa. You know, if you're dying of hunger, you know, the fact that somebody in Brisbane has run a marathon for them, that's going to do wonders, right? I mean, it's kind of like, really? but people lap it up. They say, oh, you're so caring. What do you mean? You know, why don't you send all the money you spend on your trainers directly somewhere, or go and actually help the people you say you care about? But they don't want to do that. Oh, no, that's getting their hands dirty.
Yeah. All right. We have a bunch of questions for you from the other attendees here. Peter, you want to go ahead?
Thanks, Dave. And hi, Paul. Thanks for all of that information. I just wanted to pick you up on something that you mentioned regarding Sweden about the comparison with the neighbors. Because being based in the UK, a lot of people were talking about the situation in Europe during the start of a pandemic, and they were saying that Sweden is actually not a case that supports the anti-lockdown side. The number of deaths from COVID were much higher than all of its neighbours, and that was basically the central argument that people were using to justify why lockdowns were effective at fighting COVID. So I wondered if you could just expand a bit more on that and explain why you think that's wrong.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it definitely is wrong. That's sort of outdated, kind of both information, but also updates. So one of the things to look at is for Scandinavia as a whole, we have these restriction index, which sort of try and measure the degree of lockdowns, if you will. And Sweden did some of that, as was said before, you know, they banned large gatherings. There were also travel restrictions. But the big things that hurt an economy and particularly hurt the social systems, they didn't do. So they never closed the schools. They didn't make it mandatory that you couldn't go and visit your family and your friends. They didn't close businesses. And so the economy and the social system functioned much better. So in our definition, they never had a lockdown. But the key thing to know about their neighbors, and so this is Denmark, Norway, Finland, and Iceland, is that on average, they had even less restrictions than Sweden. So if you go back to sort of January 2020 and you go up to right now, that on average, there's almost no difference between the degree of restrictions between all those countries. They all count in our book as pragmatic countries, meaning that, yes, some of the neighbors had a lockdown for a short amount of time, but then they even more radically switched away from the lockdowns, right? And they've now sort of almost promised they're not going to go into lockdown and say, unless something really weird happens, and they've done that as a region. So A, hence the difference between Sweden and their neighbors in terms of policy is much less, right? It's small degrees of difference. In terms of outcomes, the outcomes have been, as it were, relatively good in that entire region. So Sweden has had something like that, half the number of COVID deaths of the UK per million. But of course, by not disrupting their own health system, they then had negative excess deaths following that. Whereas, of course, the UK has had more problems. And there's something else to say about Sweden and these other countries in a way, which is that they've learned from each other, right? So the Norwegian health authorities, who did go in for a lockdown, they sort of saw the light and they apologized to their population and sort of, oh, sorry, you know, we've been draconian, right? And we shouldn't have, that's created problems. And similarly for the Swedish health authority, you know, they sort of decided that, okay, what they did with their nursing homes wasn't the smartest thing. And they apologized for that bit. It's not that they apologized for not going into lockdowns. It's sort of, you know, in their whole health policies, they had some winners, they had some losers. They apologized for the losers, but they were still proud of how they did on average. And that is an adult conversation they had with their own populations. Where have we had this in the UK? When have the health authorities sort of said, oh, we got that bit right, that bit wrong. We're now learning this from our neighbors. It's been totally absent. And so, you know, Scandinavia as a whole for me is kind of the shining light within Europe. This is what we can be. And it works, and it works much better. You know, all the indicators are there better for all their countries than they are in southern parts of Europe.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Stefano, you also have a question?
Yes, thank you, Saif. And thank you, Paul, for coming on. This has been fascinating. It's great to see that there are academics that actually have an open mind and look at things the way you do. So my question is the following. Two of the elements that you mentioned that could be motivating what happened over the last couple of years are economic or financial incentive, and then there's clearly a control motive from politicians, right? What I still don't quite understand, and I'm curious to know what your opinion is if that were the case, then why are they pushing so hard vaccine mandates that make absolutely no sense in terms of ignoring natural immunity, pushing vaccine on healthy kids? To me, this seems counterproductive because in a way it's seeding or it's planting the seeds of their own demise. So how do you see vaccine mandates, and what do you think is actually behind that?
I agree vaccine mandates are an interesting case study, right? I'm against vaccine mandates. I think people should be allowed to make their own choices, particularly since it's become clear with the Delta variant that, as it were, the infectiousness of people with COVID is almost the same whether they're vaccinated or unvaccinated. And so there's no argument for forcing anybody into vaccination then. Mm-hmm. The externality, you know, how much of a threat one is to others, is almost the same. So what's the point of forcing vaccine mandates on people? It should be a personal choice. If the risk is personal, then also the choice should be personal. And particularly for kids, of course, it's not clear at all that the side effects are not much worse than what you could possibly gain. I mean, kids are hardly affected by this COVID stuff. Mm-hmm. They're hardly infectious, probably. But some of the side effects, particularly for teenage boys, are looking to be worse and worse with the data coming in. Right? So I have asked myself, why the hell these vaccine mandates? And I think it's partially driven by the pharmaceuticals who make money off this and like the idea that the whole population gets this. You also sort of destroy the control group. I sort of buy that argument a little bit, which is there's no part of the population which doesn't have them and hence shows that you are sort of wrong to vaccinate everybody, right? It is also, I think, easy, right? So in a control situation, if you don't want to sort of measure who's vaccinated, who's not, who's had the disease, had natural immunity, then you don't need to measure that. You don't need to have special rules for. And so it's also part of the control fantasy, which is, you know, a little bit the dictator just doesn't want to deal with these difficulties. Just not everybody needs to vaccinate. And if you're not doing what I say, then you're bad because you're not doing what I say. So there's also the control fantasy that, you know, God is always right. And hence, you know, government is now always right. And it doesn't matter if they're wrong. People should treat them as if they're right anyway. They've become so arrogant that, you know, they no longer even think they need to take their population seriously on this.
Yeah, I think that's very astute.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nasser, fresh from the 5-0 defeat of Manchester United after Salah's.
Oh my God! Don't say that. I had a feeling you were there, but I did not mention stuff like that in a podcast. But here you go.
Go ahead.
I remember that in a podcast in the future as well.
Might be a while.
What my question is, I agree with you. Thank you, everything. Thank you for everything, Paul. You've said I agree with almost everything, well, maybe everything you've said. I just had a discussion with a friend a couple of days ago, and we were talking about what positive thing that COVID made that wasn't meant to be. And we came up, or he was like more about like, it's remote working. It's the best thing that ever happened. Do you agree with that statement? Or is there anything else positive that you would say happened without meaning to happen, or could potentially be something good for humanity?
Well, I don't think working at home has shown us anything beneficial so far, because it's been bad for social relationship. It's not reduced, as it were, fossil fuel usage, because, you know, the trains have been running and people have been going in cars more. And of course, you know, computers and houses need air conditioning, so it's not helped with that either. So I've not seen the benefits of all this working at home. It just made people less empathic, because they don't get out and about and see us with the damage of the policy so much. So it's made the whole society less social. So I don't see that as a positive. Although in my class, if you like, you know, the laptop class, the academics, lots of people love it. But I think that's a bit selfish that they love it. It's for sort of reasons which are not sustainable. But if I were to say what's positive, I see two positive things. One is that we've sort of learned how corrupt our societies already were, and how huge the influence of big money is on our society. And I didn't realize how bad it already was in my own countries. And so there's a bit of an eye opener as, oh my God, is this bad? And so with that, you know, one of the positive things is this outgrowth of citizen journalism, of sort of alternative media channels, a true challenging, if you like, of these monopolies which we have in so many industries, including the media industry, including the internet industries. So there is as it were, the counter movement has started, and I've wanted the counter movement to start, but this has really forced it out, because it's so obviously negative what's happening now to so many people. Another good thing, I think, and we'll see how this goes, is that always in a crisis, you try out new weapons, you try out new toys, and you never know, some of those new toys may be very positive. And so, for instance, the vaccines on malaria, they may have been sped up because of this, or people were more prepared to try them out. And so the willingness to try out different types of vaccines, I wasn't against that. You know, that would have sped up their development. And that means that maybe in the future, when other nasty things come around, or we try to tackle diseases which humanity have had for a long time and have not tackled so far, we will be more successful. And so I think in some sense, a part of the medical technology breakthroughs, I think might count, for me at least, as a long run positive. But of course, on innovation in general, we've probably lost net innovation because we've shut down so many industries. So, you know, a lot of our best scientists have been spending their time doing bollocks or doing nothing. And whole countries have reduced so much in economic activity, that's also less innovation. But in that particular area, we might have, as it were, sped up innovation. And that might turn out to be a good thing.
Markita, did you want to comment about that?
Sorry. Sure. Yeah, I think one of the things, particularly for this group, this whole lockdown thing and COVID, it really helped us to accelerate more how to navigate this information age, and particularly the mobile wave and the mobile information wave, and the fact that, you know, we're all connected now. I'm making the assumption that maybe, you know, Saifedean wouldn't have been able to carry out the Bitcoin standard education as effectively or as efficiently if we all weren't home, you know, wanting to connect and learn more about ways to navigate things like this. I think for those of us that needed to learn how to navigate the internet, in the event that these crazy, you know, hysteria events happen, now we know the internet is the saving grace of, you know, when these things happen, because they can happen anytime.
Look, I find it a very interesting perspective and very difficult to give a good answer to that, because yes, I do think that this has sped up the degree to which, you know, a lot of humanity has been plugged into the internet, which hasn't before, and hence has discovered some of the benefits of the internet, some of the benefits of mobile phone technology. And that is learning about things they otherwise wouldn't be exposed to. But I think for a while I've been sort of on the fence whether I think that increasing digitization is a good thing for humanity, because there are a couple of developments in the last 5 to 25 years which are associated with that digitization, with the rise of the internet, mobile phone technology, which are negative. And so I'm sort of close to starting to say that those negatives are starting to outweigh the positives. So one of the negatives is that we are getting distracted by our mobile phone and the internet all the time. And that's the nature of, as it were, the deal. You get programs for free, but you get distracted all the time. And that distraction is costing us intelligence. So I think that's one of the major reasons why IQs are now dropping quite fast in quite a lot of Western countries. So I think that's a major problem coming there, right? The distraction aspect. And the other aspect is that it is also empowering governments, and governments are empowered with a lag, but then they do take full advantage of it. So it is also allowing the surveillance society to emerge, and we're seeing that in spades during COVID times. And that is something that doesn't just go away, right? That kind of technology will stick around. And so I worry about that. And so I'm on the fence. I see some of the great benefits of the internet and mobile phones. You know, it has definitely, I think, helped economic growth in Africa and risen up a lot of people out of poverty. So I do see its benefits, but I'm starting to see negatives. I'm wondering when the moment is that the negatives outweigh the positives.
Yeah, I guess if we were going to say that maybe the biggest positive from our perspective is probably Bitcoin, although we could argue about whether this was all pre-programmed and all of the COVID stuff was maybe a rounding error in Bitcoin's trajectory. Who knows? But Peter has a follow-up question.
Me again. Yeah. So I just had a question, Paul, about something you said regarding narratives on the COVID pandemic. When you were talking about the consequences of spending all of this money and printing all of this money in order to pay for furloughs and things like that during the COVID pandemic. And you said that you think that afterwards people will have moved on and they'll start blaming the consequences of those decisions on other things. I wanted to ask whether you see that happening in other areas of economic life. Being a fellow Brit, one area that comes to mind is Brexit. And as soon as the Brexit vote happened, I knew that everyone would be sort of blaming everything bad that happened on Brexit. And I just wondered if you could speak a bit about this kind of this tendency when people think about economics, because it's such a sort of nebulous subject with so many different factors that influence the macroscopic outcomes. I wonder whether you think that there is a general tendency for people to kind of misdiagnose what happens based on a pre-existing narrative that they have.
I think there's definitely such tendencies. I think there are a couple of ingredients that are important there. One is that people forget hurt. So as a stylized rule of thumb, they sort of get over hurt. So, you know, actual physical hurt, but also many mental health problems, the death of loved ones, they get over that within about a year. So if you as a politician inflict huge pain on your population, but the election is more than 12 months out, it won't affect the election much, right? So they get over it, and then they don't want to remember the pain because it's sort of gone, right? And it's an interesting evolutionary question why people don't remember pain. Maybe that's the reason why women have more than one child, for instance. But it is there, right? So one ingredient is, in time, people forget pain and forget hurt and don't want to be reminded. So they don't actively want to know. That has nothing to do with manipulation. That is human. The second thing is that, of course, you can manipulate people if you control the airwaves, if you can sort of spin stories to them. And of course, anybody who's in charge will want to say anything good is due to them and anything bad is due to either their predecessor or something that they truly can't control or some enemy. And so that dynamic works in all times, you know. So any politician up for election or even a dictator who just wants to keep support, will point to the good things and say, that's me, and the bad things, either they didn't happen or they're somebody else's mistake, or they are now an excuse for something else to happen. And I think Brexit is a great case in point, whereby, you know, it was very clear Brexit was going to lead to lots and lots of troubles. And now that the troubles are here, you see the politicians blame all kinds of people. You know, the French fishermen are to blame, or the Polish truck drivers are to blame, or, you know, why won't Brussels sort of, you know, have different rules for Northern Ireland to the ones we just agreed with Brussels, right? But that's, I see that as normal politics. I see that as almost inevitable. You know, politicians in any system will work that way. And that hence is a matter of how mature is the population? Have you got good media that can be trusted, that sort of, you know, gives you perspectives? And so there I would point more to the distortion in the whole media system we have now, that there is just such poor information to the majority of the population. And that combined with the incentives, which have always been there to sort of, you know, misdirect people's anger and unhappiness. Yeah, of course, you know, any negatives of the great COVID panic are going to be misdirected and abused, as they have been many times, right? I mean, that's the story of wars. That's the story of previous recessions. It was always depending on the persons with the airwaves who got blamed. You want to look for examples over history, you know, think of all the Jews who were killed in the plague pandemics of Europe. You know, that was the scapegoat, whereas they had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, it's a terrifying idea.
Interesting point about remembering pain. I think that's true. Yeah, thinking back at history, thinking about wars and how societies adapt very quickly.
Yeah, yep. We get over pain. It's very interesting, and also it's interesting. If we remember jealousy, we are jealous. But if you remember physical pain, you don't remember the actual pain. You don't actually feel an echo of the pain. So we're also wired not to remember pain, right? And God knows why. But one of my favorite explanations is that this helps women have more than one pregnancy, right? They forget the pain. Yes, that's, you can remember the pain, but you don't feel the pain again when you remember it, right? And that's the thing. Whereas for many, many negative things emotionally, we re-feel it. If we remember anger, we're angry again. But if we remember pain, we don't feel pain again.
Markita is saying, we remember the pain of childbirth, by the way. I'm going to take her word over yours, Paul, on that one.
Yeah. I have a wife and three kids.
Okay, well, Paul, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us. And I really look forward to our next conversation on Bitcoin. I think this has laid the groundwork very well, because we agree on pretty much everything when it comes to, well, maybe not everything, but we have a lot of agreement on here. So I think we'll have some fertile ground.
Absolutely.
In our discussion on Bitcoin, I'm quite optimistic. We'll get you orange pilled, as the term goes.
Maybe I have the same optimism for the opposite reason. You never know. But we should enjoy ourselves, definitely.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll be in touch about scheduling discussion.
Thank you very much for putting me on the show. It was grand. And thank you all for sort of, you know, thoughtful comments. And yeah, and great to see that there is a club which so obviously looks at this whole stuff reasonably. I mean, you have each other. I mean, bloody hell.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what's kept us sane.
Yeah. You all live in different countries as well, right? So you can't go to the pub afterwards. That's a pity.
Yeah, well, you know, this is basically our pub. Well, nobody can go to the pub anyway these days. Most places.
That's the advantage of having a family that's skeptical. We can drink together.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Cheers. Take care.
Great to talking to all of you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.